This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to XYZ, the CNC podcast. I am your handsome host, Aaron Goff, and I'm joined here by our fearless leader, Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives. How are you, mate?
I'm good. We need to work this out. Are we XYZ or XYZ?
Oh, one of my friends chirped me pretty hard for saying Z.
Depends what continent we're in, I suppose.
Yeah.
I'm good. I'm just very cold. It's gone freezing almost overnight here. Not Canada cold like you, but for me, it's very, very cold here.
Is your house well insulated or is it freezing?
It's freezing. It's like super old. My house is 600 right. years old. It is literally freezing.
I think so that's the big difference between Canada and everywhere else. Like in Australia, it gets, you know, at my parents' house, it gets down to a couple of degrees and it's freezing. And here it's, you know, everyone has the heat blasting. It's like 40 degrees inside when it's...
Yeah. You're prepared for it, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's been a week since our first episode and that's flown by. Absolutely flown by.
Yes, it has. Jesus.
Yeah, and we've had some good reports from people. So we've had lots of messages from people on Instagram saying how much they enjoy the show, how much they're looking forward to the next shows. We have actually had a review as well. So we are now on basically all the platforms. So Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and so on. But we've had our first review, which is great.
Yeah, hopefully they didn't talk shit about us too much.
It's all good. It's all good. So this was from somebody called Karate T, Karate T-shirt, I think he calls himself. And he just said, yeah, great, we need to hear more. So that's, you know, that's positive. That's encouraging, I suppose.
Well, just from the name, I know who that guy is. So he might be a bit biased.
Oh, okay. Is it you by any chance?
No, it's Mike. I know who that is. That's an inside joke.
Well, he enjoys it anyway, so that's good news.
He'd better.
Good news.
Well, I thought we could start out the week with some inspiring engineering stuff.
Sure.
You know, there's always amazing things going on in the world, and all of this stuff is only made possible with CNC. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what have you seen? Have you seen anything special this week?
Well, the first one doesn't sound inspiring until you get into it. It sounds horrifying. But I'm not sure if you follow Formula One at all.
In and out, and I know there was some terrible crash on the weekend with a big fireball and all
there
the rest
was,
of it.
But, yeah. Yeah. So it's CNC related because it's actually the Haas F1 team that this happened to. It was one of their drivers, Romain Grosjean, went into a steel barrier at 220 kilometers an hour.
Oh, jeez.
And the chassis of his car experienced a 53G deceleration when it hit the wall. And the barrier that he hit actually failed. So he got squeezed through the barrier at 200 kilometers an hour, and he walked away from it.
That just goes to show, you know, that the safety involved in, you know, in the building of these cars and so on. But
yeah,
my God, that sort of speed.
The engineering involved in this is just insane. You know, he's very lucky as well, but like, oh my God. When I saw the video, I was like, oh, there's 0% chance that he survived that. 0%.
Wow, and those little cabins, those little cabins they're in, the cockpits are, that there's literally no room at all, is there? There's no, you know,
no.
There's no wiggle room there at all. If they hit something, there's nothing going to be sort of sucked. The impact isn't going to be sucked up by anything else, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, the chassis around them is actually designed to kind of explode and dissipate energy. And then there's like a survival tub that's just around the driver itself. But yeah, like it's amazing. Like in a road car, that would have been definitely. The end. So
yes. Just the end.
The end, yes. So that's it's just amazing. It's amazing to me to see something like that happen. And for him to be fine.
Yeah. I haven't actually seen the video. I only saw still images that, you know, from the news putting out the still images and so on. But yeah, it looked horrific.
Yes. It looks even worse in the video. But you can watch it and you'll be okay because you know he's fine. I hate watching videos where it ends and you're like, oh my God, was that person okay?
There's this jeopardy, yeah.
Yeah, but in this case, you're like, oh, okay, he's okay. So you can kind of watch it and appreciate the drama. It's insane, yeah.
Yeah. How would you get back into another car, you know, after that? You know, it's like the whole thing, getting back on the horse. But, you know.
I wouldn't. I honestly, Craig, like, I have to admit, I don't think I could after being in something like that, I don't think I could. I don't know how he's going to. I hope he does, but like, yeah. So terrifying.
So there'll obviously be a big investigation as to what failed, but is there any idea at the moment of what happened?
Unfortunately, it was driver error. He darted across the track to try and get the inside line and didn't realize that there was another car behind him in his blind spot. And so he clipped them, and then that put him off his line, and he just went straight into the wall.
Oh, jeez.
They might look at the visibility out of the cars, because you can't, he obviously couldn't see the car that was in his blind spot, so they need to do something about that, most likely.
Wow. But, crazy times.
Yeah, and then the other exciting thing that's coming up is that SpaceX are going to be doing the first proper test flight of their Starship on Wednesday, I believe.
Wow. The day this show comes out.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So that's going to be amazing. I mean, they say there's about a 30% chance that it's just going to spectacularly blow up. Rapid rapid unscheduled disassembly.
Boom.
Yeah, but that'll be very exciting to see that.
Yeah, and I love the fact that they're showing everything that they do as well, you know, so, you know, they'll have the live streams and all the rest of it, but crazy times again.
Yeah, and the early versions of the engines that are in that rocket were about 40% by mass 3D printed.
Wow. Not in PLA. PLA.
bit of ABS.
Yeah.
Aerospace grade and ABS, you know? Yeah.
So they're printed directly with metal, molten metal, I assume.
Yes. I believe it was... like laser powder, like powder bed laser. So they're basically using like a metal powder and then using a laser to fuse the metal powder together.
Right.
I believe there are some parts of their process that they don't really show too much.
Yeah. Wowzers. 3D printed rockets.
Yeah. Amazing, right?
Welcome to the future.
Right.
So we've had a few sort of, well, I wouldn't say questions, for a few topics that people would like us to talk about. So we don't know who our audience is yet. This will develop into something, but I can imagine that we've got a bunch of hobbyists listening. We probably have a bunch of knife makers as well who are, you know, taking their first steps into CNC, or experts in CNC, just laughing at the rubbish that I say, quite possibly. but I thought we could talk about maybe routes into CNCing.
For
hobbyists and what options are out there, because there's lots of options, and if you don't know what you're looking for, you know, what's the best bang for your buck, I suppose.
Yeah, and honestly, this is going to be an area where you probably are more up to date than I am.
Really? Well, I doubt it very much. I mean, I've been looking for the last maybe month for a way to cut out handle materials, which we did talk about last week. And, you know, budget-wise, I'm really constrained to more of a CNC router as opposed to, you know, a big mill. So no cutting steel, and this would literally just be for G10s. And there's a bunch out there. I mean, there's a bunch of things made especially for sort of furniture makers and carpenters, that kind of thing, that'll cut, you know, big MDF sheets, that kind of thing, of these CNC routers. And they generally come in kits, and you can build the rails as long as you want them and that kind of thing. Quite inexpensive, and a lot of them you can swap out the spindle to just use like a normal router, like a Dewalt router.
Yeah, and that actually works very well. I have owned a machine that had a Dewalt DWP 611 as the spindle, and that was pretty good actually.
Yeah, well, the machine that I ordered last week, it does come with a really underpowered spindle. I think
That little 400 watt air cooled one.
Yeah, which is pretty bad. But this does come with an adapter, so you can fit that same Dewalt router in instead. And I think they're 1500 watt. I think these are certainly the European spec anyway.
Right.
So that'll be something that I'll be doing, and I'm pretty sure that'll work fine for, you know, for small slabs of G10 that I'll be using. So
Yeah, it'll be fine. It definitely much. I was going to talk shit to you last week about the spindle when I looked up a photo of the machine you bought. So I'm glad you're replacing it with the router.
Yes, yeah. I think that spindle would be okay for sort of, engraving soft woods, that kind of thing, but you know, nothing that I'd be doing. So yeah, that's the first thing to upgrade on that, really.
Yeah, but so in terms of spindles though, you might want to look at Makita have a router that's very similar in size with a wider RPM range. So one of the issues that you'll have is just trying to get the RPM low enough in order to achieve a decent chip load. So if you're taking too small of a chip load, you're going to burn out your tools really quick. So particularly in G10. So basically the chip load is how much material the end mill is cutting away each time it turns.
Right, okay, per revolution.
Yes. And for G10, because it's a very abrasive material, if you're just kind of spinning a lot without removing much material, then the G10 has lots of opportunities to wear away your end mill.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so basically the first symptom of that will be that it destroys the edge. So you'll start getting worse finishes. So the DeWalt router, the DWP611, I believe it goes down to 16,000 RPM, whereas the Makita version goes down to 10,000.
Oh, right. Okay. So that's quite a big change. Yeah.
Yeah. And they both are actually really cool in that they have like electronic speed control. So they, when you load the spindle up, like, so when you start taking a cut, it senses that it's, you know, something's working to slow it down and actually pumps in more power to keep the speed consistent.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Which is super important for a little CNC machine. So
yeah,
you might want to look at that. It's a really good option.
Will do, will do. I knew, I've got a pen with me and a pad here, and I knew I'd be taking notes immediately, so thank you for that.
Oh, I go into black holes with this stuff, you know. I look at something and then 4 hours later it's 2 a.m. and
so I mean, we mentioned last week you're using your main mill, which I know you're running two now as well, aren't you? We
can talk about
that in just a sec. But so you're cutting G10 on that as well as your steel. What bits are you using, or cutting tools are you using, rather, for G10?
Good question. Yeah, so for the most part, I actually use a variety of tools. G10 isn't especially sensitive to tooling, from what I've seen. So you'd be fine with like a two-flute carbide end mill or a ball mill, you know, whether it's like steel optimized or aluminum optimized isn't going to make a huge difference from what I've seen.
Okay.
My general tooling is I use coated four-flute solid carbide ball end mills, and they come from the company that makes all my tooling, which is Maritool, and they're fantastic. And then for my finishing, I'm actually using diamond tooling.
Right, okay.
So probably not something I would recommend for a small router. Because, so basically with the diamond tooling, you can only get them with straight flutes, which means that they kind of bang in and out of the cut, rather than with a spiral flute, the cutting happens more gradually. So the load on the spindle is more constant and you don't get this like banging in and out of the cut. Whereas with a straight flute tool, like the diamond tool, it really is kind of like smashing into the G10 and scraping it off rather than like...
Yeah.
You know, cutting it away. But the advantage is that the diamond doesn't get worn down by the glass fibers in the G10. So it leaves a really nice finish and you always get the parts that are the same size.
Right, okay. Yeah, there's no sort of abrasion to the tool, so there's right, I got you.
Yeah, no size change. But the cost is pretty astronomical. Like Maritool introduced those tools for me. Like at my request, which is amazing. Thanks, Frank, for that. But yeah, they're like $250 US each.
Wow. Okay. We will actually put links to Maritool and anything else that we're talking about down in the show notes. So if you're listening, you don't have to be like me and have a pen and make notes of everything. We put all down in the show notes and you'll find that at makery.network where the show is. All those notes and links will be there.
That'd be great. And yeah, it probably sounds like I'm shilling for them, but they don't give me any money. They just look after me really, really well.
Yeah, here, but I think any time you find something that's a value, I'm more than happy to give shout-outs, that kind of thing. It makes perfect sense.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, totally. So, yeah, like, does that... I mean, for you, you might be better off trying to find, like, a single flute end mills of some kind because, you know, you don't have the ability to drop the RPM down low enough to really use, like, a four flute.
Yes, yeah. I hadn't given that much thought about the DeWalt having too many RPMs and that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so when I had my little router with the DeWalt spindle, that was definitely a real problem. I'd pretty much always be running it at the minimum RPM. And, you know, even that was usually too much.
Yeah. How are, again, I'm just drilling you with questions.
That's fine.
How are you holding down your G10? Do you have a fixture which you hold down with, or have you got like a vacuum bed or anything like that at all?
I have a special fixture. So basically it's done in two operations. The first operation, I'm actually machining the underside of a piece of G10. And so what I do is I drill four holes and then I come in with a thread mill and actually cut threads inside those holes. Oh. And then I flip it over and I can actually bolt. I have like a removable pallet that's part of my second fixture, and I can actually bolt through the bottom of the pallet into the G10. So it's each handle scale. So the G10 that I'm cutting up gets cut into two handle scales, and each handle scale is held down by two bolts.
Right. So you don't need any tabs or anything at all. The actual exactly. handle itself, not just the waist.
Yeah, so it means nice. I'm able to machine every surface and all the critical dimensions in that second setup, all in one go.
You clever bastard.
Yeah, that's like the one thing in my fixturing that I haven't changed. It's just worked, which is fantastic.
Nice. Yeah. So we were talking about introductions, I suppose, machines for people getting into CNC. And I've done a quick look online to see the kind of stuff.
A quick look. You've been looking for weeks.
I have been for myself.
Really. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But there's lots of sort of generic machines out there, which I think Chinese factories are buying. They're slapping their own sort of badges on them, maybe giving them a paint job and listing it as their own. They all look very, very similar. Right. But aside from that, I said there's lots made out there, I suppose, for woodworkers, such as the Shape Oko, the Stepcraft machines.
And one you don't have listed that is something I would recommend is the Probotics machines.
Right, okay.
So one of my friends who's a guitar maker just bought one of those, and he's been really happy. And one of my earlier machines was an earlier version of one of their machines, and you know, it was a bit janky because of the time that it came out. When things were more expensive for CNC, but it was still very good. It lasted many, many years. In fact, it's still going. It's been through four owners at this point, and it's still going.
Well, nice. So with regards to specs, I mean, this is difficult because we don't know what our listeners are making, but let's say they're doing knives. Because I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be.
Right.
And they want to shape the likes of G10 or maybe they've got big slabs of wood as well that they'd like to mill down. Mm-hmm. What would, spec-wise, what sort of spindle minimum wattage would you say you should be looking at?
Oh, it's a little bit of a hard question to answer because it really depends on what your tolerance for frustration is.
Ah, right, okay,
You know, because ultimately you can do good work with almost anything. It's just going to be a lot more frustrating with one of those little tiny 400 watt spindles, you know, like the one that's the default on the new machine you bought.
Yes.
I mean, I would just say, like, make sure you try to get something that has an ER collet if you can. So that's one of the failings of like the DeWalt and the Makita routers, that it's a little bit hard to get collets for them for different sizes of tools. And that kind of restricts your flexibility a little bit. But yeah, you know, 400 watts and up. Definitely don't go smaller than that. And even at 400 watts, you're going to have to be taking pretty small cuts.
Yeah, light passes on that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Something else which I've been sort of trying to delve into is lead screws or ball screws. It seems to me that ball screws are the way to go, but you'll look in some forums and some are saying, no, lead screws, and you think... What are the differences and what are the pros and cons, do you think, of each?
So the main difference is a lead screw is basically like a bolt and a nut. There's really nothing special about it apart from the thread shape. So they use what's called like a buttress thread, which means that it's more square rather than triangular. Whereas a ball screw uses a rolling ball bearing as the interface between the nut and the bolt. So both the nut and the bolt have grooves in them, And then in those grooves, there are ball bearings that roll and lock the nut and the bolt together, the screw and the nut. So the biggest difference is efficiency. With a lead screw, you're only getting about 50% efficiency. So all of the power that your stepper motor or your servo motor can put out, only about 50% of that is translated into movement. And the rest is basically translated into friction and heat. Whereas with a ball screw, the efficiency is like above 90%, 90 to 95. Okay. But ball screws are more fussy. You have to be nicer to them. You know, they have much tighter tolerances. They have lots of moving parts. So if you fill them with dust, then they'll, you know, potentially lock up or wear prematurely. Whereas lead screws, particularly if they have like a self-adjusting nut. So there are lots of lead screws these days that have like spring-loaded nuts that kind of clamp more onto the lead screw as they wear out.
Yeah.
Which means you can be pretty nasty to them and they'll keep working until they don't. And they're relatively cheap to replace. So the biggest difference in terms of performance is going to be like your maximum acceleration and your maximum cutting speeds. Both of those will be better with a ball screw because of the higher efficiency. And then, yeah, there's the cost to consider. Lead screws are significantly less expensive than ball screws.
Hmm. And from what I can gather, there's the likelihood of more backlash with a lead screw as opposed to a ball screw as well, because you've got that little slight wiggle room, I suppose.
It kind of depends, actually. If you're using anti-backlash nuts, so the ones, they're basically, they have like a spring-loaded kind of clamp mechanism that forces the nut further into the threads of the lead screw as it wears, then those are actually effectively zero backlash and will be for their lifetime. Whereas ball screws are kind of interesting. Like the only way to eliminate backlash in a ball screw is actually to make the balls very slightly larger than the grooves. So you end up kind of eliminating any slop. But most of the inexpensive ball screws are not preloaded like that. So, right, okay. But it kind of also kind of depends on what your definition of backlash is. You know, for hobby guys, anything under a thousandth of an inch, it might be totally fine. And cheap ball screws are totally, you know, in that realm.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas for me, a thousandth of an inch would be like a really big problem on one of my machines.
Disaster.
Yes. That would be like me rebuilding a machine at that point.
Wow.
So yeah, it depends a bit for sure. Like there's no, oh, this is the right answer. I would tend toward ball screws personally. But they're definitely more complicated to keep alive in a small machine.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I think if we go back to this each week, I think mm-hmm. we'd be basically building the perfect machine. If we can take little bits by little bit each week, we'll end up with what should be a perfect machine.
Sounds pretty good to me. Yeah. So I mean, so much of that stuff is just dictated by budget too.
Oh yeah, certainly.
If you're fine with 60 inches a minute feed rate, you know, and it's your first CNC machine and you want something that you're not going to have to think about too much, then absolutely go for lead screws. But beyond that, ball screws are probably the best option.
Gotcha. So whilst looking for myself and to answer this question about, mm-hmm. you know, beginner machines out there, I've come across some pretty weird machines as well.
Awesome.
Have you seen that Shaper Origin, like handheld?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have. Yeah, you have to put like barcodes on your bit of wood and then...
How weird is that?
I think they're super cool. I don't know how practical they are, but I think they're a really cool idea.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure. So those who haven't seen, it's like a handheld router, like a wood router that you'd hold in the hand. But what I can assume, the spindle has like a head on it, which has a bit of travel and play on there.
Yeah.
So you have a screen at the top, and as long as you sit within this sort of channel, the head will move to keep things. I don't know how accurate they are, but that, you know, as accurate as you know as it should do. So it's a very strange handheld CNC machine, and it's not cheap. It's, you know, for a handheld machine. I don't know who the customer would be for that. It's quite a weird one.
I don't know either. But I mean, if you're trying to process like a full know, 4 foot by 8 foot sheet of MDF or plywood or something, and you need like a kind of a complex shape, then, you know, maybe it makes sense. It's a really interesting concept.
Sign makers, maybe making a big sign, you know, and you don't have, you know, that size bed on it, like, like an enormous CNC, but that could work well. But yeah, very strange one. I'm sure we'll come across lots of strange CNC machines over the coming weeks or two.
Oh, I love it. The weirder the better. Send them in. Like, if you find something super weird, let us know.
And with regards to letting us know about things, we've already mentioned we had a review on the show. If you listen to the show and you enjoy it, the best thing you can do for us to help us out is actually to give us a review on whatever platform it is that you listen to. So whether it's Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, whatever it is, a review really helps us get discovered by more people. So the funnier, the better, we find too. Funny reviews are always good.
And hopefully they're not. Hopefully they're not all Mike.
Yeah, Mike under a different name each week. But yeah, reviews are good, unless they're bad reviews. And if that's the case, just don't listen to us. It's fine. We're happy with that. We're good.
Write it on a letter and send it to Santa.
Yeah. So we've talked about machines. You, I've noticed this week, are now running two machines in tandem. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. It's honestly a little overwhelming. I like... just trying to keep up with them at this point. So yeah, for the first time ever, I've been running both of my CNC mills machining blades, just because I'm pushing super hard at the moment to try and get caught up by the end of the year. And yeah, it's been amazing. It's been fantastic. It's just, as I said, it's overwhelming because I have to do the rest of the process by hand on these blades after they come off. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, there's so many.
Well, what do you have left? What are you doing manually at the end?
Hand sanding, all the final finishing, like, you know, checking all of the parts. Then they go into tumbling, and then I have to sandblast them by hand. So it's really the hand sanding I say that. I also hate the sandblasting. But
which is why you're making that machine.
Yes. Yeah. Next year, hopefully.
Sandblast 2000.
Yeah. It's going to be amazing. Yeah. Next year, hopefully, I'll have, you know, my goal is to try and clear some space. You know, I'm trying to make some space in my time, my life at the moment, so that next year I can push a lot harder on automation. And, you know, making that CNC sandblasting machine is going to be one of the big ones for sure.
Yeah. You're going to have to get one of those big robot arms next to just take things out of machines and put into the next one and do all that for you.
Dude, I found one on Kijiji a while ago. This guy was selling a six-axis Kawasaki robot arm. And it was like a cute little baby-sized one. It was only about 2 feet high. It was like $4,000. I wasn't in the best spot financially at that time. And I was trying to justify in my head. I was like, no, I totally need a CNC, like a robot arm, right? I didn't end up buying it, unfortunately, but yeah.
It'd be so much fun. So much fun.
They're so dangerous, though. Like,
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so there are newer types that are called collaborative robots that are designed to detect when they hit something and then stop, you know, so you can safely work around them without a cage or anything. But the old style ones, like what this was, like they'll, you know, if they're holding like a knife and they're turning around and you're in the way, they're not going to stop.
Particularly with knives as well. Yeah. It's probably not the best thing.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. A mad flailing robot covered in knives. It's not a great thing.
But I mean, what you've just said there of sort of clearing the decks, ready for New Year to almost start afresh. I'm in that position at the moment. So I've worked on a number of sort of bigger batches this year, and they've all now shipped.
That's fantastic.
So my focus now is back to design, really, to design a new batch for the new year.
Nice.
And I think I'm going to do things slightly different. So whereas I'd normally make a few prototypes, and you know, take photos of these and all the rest of it, then put them up for sort of pre-sale.
Right.
Then for the next couple of months, I'll be working on them, then ship them out. I'm going to do it with less stress this time. So I'm going to prototype them, make them all in sort of stealth mode, if you like, then have a sort of a launch and say, well, I've got 80 of these knives, and you know, first 80 have them.
Yes.
I think that's the way to work going forward for me, because that whole thing of, you know, front loading the sale and then having the, there's no reward at the end.
Yeah.
Of making everybody's knife.
It's funny, actually. That's one of the things that I want to do next year as well. Is for exactly the same reasons. Cause it's, you know, when you do like a pre-order, a pre-sale, you know, the money goes very quickly to rent and materials and everything. And then when you're finishing the knife, it feels a little bit like you're paying money, like you're paying like the shipping and, you know, all that stuff. It feels a little bit like you're paying money to make a knife.
Yeah. Psychologically, it's all a bit weird.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm at that point now where I'm designing a new range of knives, nice. But I'm actually going to do two in tandem. So they're going to be chef knives again, mm-hmm. back to sort of what I've always done. But they're going to be at two different price points. So the point is, one will be very big, no hand sanding even, very sort of base. I mean, they'll function in exactly the same way, but aesthetically they'll look different. So there'll be two ranges. There'll be a raw range and a garnished range. So I'm looking forward to that. And it's quite fun just to be, you know, trying out new things again and not having the pressure of, I need to get these done and ship these out, you know?
Totally.
So, I've got what? Basically all of December to do that now. So, it's quite a good place to be in at the moment.
All of December. That's not that much time, Craig.
A month for me is a long, long time.
Yeah, your time management must be very good because you produce other podcasts. You're a host of another podcast. You have kids and a wife and a business. Like, I don't know how you do it.
I don't produce half as many knives as many other makers. And I'm sure I produce, you know, a tiny percentage of knives compared to yourself. But things will be changing next year. So it's
nice.
It's exciting.
Sounds great. Yeah. It's always a struggle dealing with your process. And there's a lot of like mental stuff involved in that. Like we were talking about with the pre-sales versus having knives ready to go. It's interesting how much tuning there is involved in that stuff.
Yeah. But I find sort of marketing-wise, it's really weird how I started doing these batches. So about a year ago, I thought, well, rather than sell one knife to one person, that's a lot of admin, a lot of emails going back and forth. You know, one custom knife is a lot of work,
yes.
Aside from the making. So I thought, well, I'll do these batches of maybe 50 or 80 or 100 knives and then put them up. And they're like, almost like a limited edition, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And it's a weird psychological thing with people, I think. If they know it's limited, there's only 50, they really, right. really want one.
Right.
But if I do I've had a custom chef knife, which I finished probably about a month ago. It's a one-off, which is still for sale.
Right.
You know, but that urgency isn't there for people. Which, you know, it's a weird sort of psychological game trying to sort of market these knives.
We need to change it to limited edition, one of one.
Maybe. I like to do these sort of, when I'm working on a batch, I like to put out like teaser videos and that kind of thing and sort of whet people's appetite for it, you know. But when you then say, look, I've got this one knife available. It's a weird thing, and they don't sell. So
might be because it's pink, Craig.
Quite possibly. You know the knife I'm talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I like it, but yeah, who knows? Maybe people don't want a pink knife.
Quite possibly. So I think batches are the way to do it going forward. Obviously, you know, for the manufacturing side of things, but also marketing wise, it does seem to work that little better. I find.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's such an important part of it. Like, it's making things is only half the battle, unfortunately.
And we talk about this a lot on Knife Talk, how, and I think this applies to whatever you're making. If you've got a small shop and you're making, you need to be, you know, head of finance, head of accounts, the cleaner. You need to make the car. You need to do everything. You need to wear a lot of hats.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's lots of people in the same situation, whether you're making widgets for XYZ or you're making knives, it's going to be the same.
100%. And this year has been especially shit for all of that. It's just been crazy. And on top of all of the regular shit from this year, I'm actually getting audited as well, which is fantastic. Yeah. The CRA, they were like, oh, you've sold, you know, this much in sales, but you've only collected, you know, like $1,800 in sales tax. And I was like, yeah, that's because I don't sell inside Canada, really. Like, nearly all of my customers are outside of Canada, which means I don't collect sales tax.
Yeah.
And the guy that's auditing me from the CRA, he was like, oh, that makes perfect sense. Why didn't they just ask you? And I was like, I don't know. And he's like, well, too bad. I've got to audit you now.
Oh, geez.
And so it's been 8 months.
Oh, man.
I left him a phone call a month and a half ago, and I still haven't heard back. You know, I have a question. Can I get an answer? It's just, yeah.
That sucks. Just a pressure hanging over you.
Oh, seriously, man. It's, yeah, it's just stupid. But yeah, as a small business owner, there's just so much stuff like that.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, also trying to juggle family and the rest of it. You know, there's a life outside of of making stuff, believe it or not.
Yeah, seriously.
So let's go back to your two machines. So you're juggling the two, and everything that's being spat out. You've got to double down on that sort of hand finishing and stuff as well.
Yep.
Are the two machines the same? Are you running them to do the same process, or are you doing one for handles, one for blades? How are you juggling them?
It's interesting, actually. So they're doing the same thing. They're both machining the bevels on my knives, but one is using a newer version of my fixtures. So it's actually a different machining process. But that was kind of an experiment. I was like, oh, I'm not sure whether this is going to work. And it's been working fantastic. And it's much simpler than my older fixtures, which is great.
Hmm. So that's going to give you a way of sort of A/B testing live, but you know, if it does go wrong, it doesn't mean you've lost everything, because you've still got one doing your regular way of doing things.
Yeah, 100%. Smart. And that was always the plan for having two machines, was that my original machine, Millie, would be my like prototyping and research and testing machine, and then the other machine, Vicky, would be my like production machine. So
why Vicky? Millie is quite obvious why it's Millie. Why Vicky?
So I had three machines at one point, and they were Vicky, Millie, and Kathy. VMC.
Ah.
Yeah. But now Kathy has gone to another home, so it's just Millie and Vicky. But yeah, that's actually worked out really well. But I just realized that, you know, there wasn't much point having Millie sitting there doing nothing. So I've got her set up to do blades, you know, so on those days when I'm working doing production, both the machines can be running doing blades, which is my longest machining process. So
So how many blades could you sort of do regards to bevels? How many bevels could you do a day with the two running?
With the two, it's like eight a day, which is, yeah, pretty nuts.
It's a slow process still then, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And that's a, like, kind of a long day. It's like 2 hours a blade for the bevel machine.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, the interesting thing about automation and about CNC is that you know, to an extent it doesn't matter if it's a bit slower. Like, I, you know, so if I was just grinding a bevel by hand, I could do it in probably an hour. I'd probably be faster than that if I practiced a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
But while I'm doing that, I can't do anything else.
Yes, yeah. So whilst the machine is doing the bevels, you're free to do other stuff.
Yeah, and I'm doing hand finishing, or I'm doing assembly and packaging and shipping, and, you know, having and that's the sandblasting robot. When I get that finished as well, you know, it's not going to be faster than doing it by hand. It's definitely not going to be. But even if it takes an hour, you know, which is many, many times slower than it'll likely be, but even if it took an hour, that would still be an improvement, because it's happening in parallel.
It's freed up your time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting to think about the process that way, that all it has to do is be faster than your slowest process. Mm. And then you can just run it in parallel and you're good to go.
Yeah. And it gives you time to learn new stuff too, to improve upon.
Absolutely.
Yes. So I've got a note here in our notes. Mm-hmm. About control software.
Mm.
And you've listed a bunch of different control software. There's Mac 3, Mac 4, Linux, CNC, Centroid, Acorn, Gerbil, G2. I haven't heard of some of these. So.
Yeah.
All the machines that I have basically run Gerbil.
Right. So how many of the others have you heard of?
Mac 3, definitely, because that's that ugly-looking thing that you see. Mac 4, I haven't actually seen. So whether they've improved the interface on that, I don't know. And yeah, I've heard of Linux CNC, never seen it in action at all.
Right.
But for those who don't know, explain what control software is.
Yeah, so the basic idea is that you take your G code as an input from, you know, so it's going to come out of your CAD software, and then it's taking that G code and controlling the machine in real time as it goes through each line in the G code. So it might be, cutting a straight line, or it might be doing an arc. And the issue with the control software is that you're having to control these motors at a very tight interval, you know, so you're telling the X motor to move across a thousandth of an inch and the Y motor to move across a thousandth of an inch. And they have to be told to do that at the same time to within, you know, microseconds, because otherwise you'll end up with weird artifacts like stair-stepping, or, you know, all sorts of strange things could go on if the timing wasn't really tight. So, yeah, I mean, that's my biggest issue with Mac 3 is that it runs in Windows. And Windows is what's called a multitasking operating system. You know, most operating systems are these days. But Windows will be happy to interrupt your CNC process with, would you like to update Windows?
Looks like you're doing CNC. Would you like help with that?
Clippy's going to help you. So Windows just isn't designed to run that kind of task. You know, it's not designed. So doing something like that with really tight timing requirements is called hard real time. So Windows is not a real time operating system. That's not what it's designed for. Right. And that's my primary criticism of something like Mac 3. Like, as you said, the interface is a bit crazy.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah. And you can actually get external modules that do the motion control outside of the computer. So there was a thing called the Smooth Stepper. I'm not sure if they're still around. But, that's kind of the way that professional grade CNC machines work, is that they have a real-time motion controller that's separate from the user interface.
Right, yeah.
You said that your machines mainly run Gerbil? Gerbil? How's it pronounced?
Gerbil, Jarbil, whatever people call it, Jarbil. I think that's because I've mainly got, you know, cheap Chinese machines.
Right.
It's open source and they don't have to pay any sort of licensing fees or make rip-off copies, which is the norm.
Right.
It's the only thing I've used, really.
Right. Yeah, I'm super impressed with that project. Like, it's the core of the motion control in that system is, you know, an Arduino, which is not a very powerful microcontroller. So it's amazing at what they've done. My primary concern is that I think there are microcontrollers these days that are just as cheap and many, many times more powerful. So that's what G2 Core is about, is that they're using an ARM microcontroller to do the motion control. So they get more space to play, basically. Like, they have a lot more grunt, a lot more horsepower.
Yeah, a bit more overhead to play with.
Yeah, and as you said, like, I think the main reason that the, like, Chinese machines are using Gerbil is because, the ATmega 328P, which is the microprocessor that the Arduino is based on, is a dollar. You know, or you can get, like, a Chinese clone of it that's 50 cents or something.
Yeah.
So for them, it just keeps the cost very, very low.
Crazy. I mean, my first sort of foray into moving things about, sort of CNC, I suppose, was way back in like primary school, being 7 or 8, and they brought in these, I don't know if you had them in the States, BBC used to make these computers.
Yeah, the turtle? Is this what you're...
The turtle, yeah. Exactly. So trying to explain to my wife what G-code is, I said, well, it's a series of commands which would generally have coordinates and maybe have speeds, that kind of thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, did you use the turtle in school? And she's like, what do you mean? I was like, well, you know, we had this BBC, I think they're BBC Acorns.
Mm.
Massive, like, big, wide, beige computers all built into the keyboard. and you'd have this really massive CRT monitor with it as well. But basically, we'd put a pen in this turtle you'd put on the floor, and it was like a little plotter, I suppose. So you'd put this pen in, and you'd say, you know, forward three, and you'd go forward three, one, two, three, turn 90 degrees right. And go, so it was this series of commands that you'd get to do things. And I remember there was things like the big tracks then as well, you know, when you talk about toys. I don't know if you ever had one of those big tracks,
no.
Which is exactly the same sort of thing. You'd give it a series of commands, forward three, right two, forward three, and hope we'd get to where it is. So that was my sort of interpretation of what G-code is and control software to my wife.
That's totally accurate. And I those turtle things are awesome. Like, I would love to have one now. It'd be so much fun.
Yeah. I mean, I'm quite loud. I've got a bunch of really old computers here that I've had since, you know, since I was little. And I've got a BBC Acorn, but I don't have a turtle. So I'll have to look on eBay, see if there's any around.
Probably worth a mint. But yeah, like, yeah, I think it's a bit of a shame that kids these days... you can tell I've grown a beard and gotten old. You know, that they miss out on that kind of stuff, because there are things like that floating around now, but they tend to be much more complicated, a bit less approachable.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I don't know about here in France, but in the UK, kids are learning this kind of stuff.
Good.
And again, mainly by the BBC. So the BBC put out these programs out there, not TV programs, but, you know, educational programs that they offer to schools for free. And yeah, kids really are getting into it and using things like Scratch, and, you know, on Raspberry Pis and things like that. So kids are sort of getting into it in the UK, and it is part of the sort of curriculum for them now, which I think is quite important.
Yeah, totally.
But you know, things, without, you know, sounding like two old men here, things have just changed so much. I remember,
get off my lawn, Craig.
Yeah, I remember. It must have been about 3 years ago. And so Raspberry Pis are, for those who don't know, they're basically little computers.
They're fucking amazing, is what they are.
They are amazing. So, I mean, we've already talked about Arduinos. There's the differences, for those who don't know. An Arduino is a microprocessor, which will just do that one continued task, whereas a Raspberry Pi is a full computer, and you can, you know, connect it to a monitor and have an operating system that you can see visually and all the rest of it. They're really cool.
They are.
But yeah, it's about 2 or 3 years ago. I'm just in the newsagents looking through magazines. And there's this magazine, and it was like £4, and it had a Raspberry Pi like attached to it.
Oh, that's
to the magazine.
Super cool.
It was like free, and I'm like, this Raspberry Pi, which is free with a magazine, has far more power than, you know, the first computers that I had as a kid.
Yep.
That cost like hundreds of pounds.
Yep.
It's just crazy how accessible things are. It's absolutely mental.
Yeah, and I think it's a bit of a shame that there aren't. So, like, the Raspberry Pi is, in my mind, like the perfect user interface computer for a CNC machine.
Hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And there is one CNC control that I know of that uses it, which is called Clipper, and that's mainly focused on 3D printing. And that's actually really a really clever system. So what it does is it takes your G-code, and ahead of time, it works out all of the moves that it's going to have to do to execute your program, and then it streams those moves as really, really simple commands to an Arduino, so the Arduino can execute them in real time. But the Arduino doesn't have to do all of the heavy lifting of working out what to do. It's just like a dumb unit, and that kind of split of responsibilities makes a ton of sense. And they did it with a Raspberry Pi and an Arduino, like really, really inexpensive off-the-shelf stuff. So yeah, big shout out to Clipper, which is another open source project. I think that's a really, really good approach.
Is that Clippo, did you say?
Clipper.
Clipper.
Clipper. Sorry, notes, yeah, and spelled with a K, I believe.
Gotcha.
Okay. So are you thinking about upgrading from Gerbil at some point? Or have you been overall happy with it?
It's all I know. So I don't know the benefits of using anything else, I suppose.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, the thing with Gerbil is everything's going to be sort of software based, I suppose, with regards to having some visual feedback. Whereas I know with Mac 3, for example, that visual feedback is part of Mac 3, isn't it? You know, you've got the UI there, which is all part of it. With Gerbil, that's literally just the not the language, I suppose, but it's the system. You many like Candle would use Gerbil as an example, or you could choose your skin of Gerbil if you like.
Right.
And it's all I know. It's what I've used, and it works, you know, for my basic needs. But I don't know the advantage of then maybe using Mark III or Mark IV. I don't know what those advantages would be.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of interesting you mentioned the visual feedback, because neither of my CNC machines have any sort of visual feedback at all.
Wow.
They're just like a text screen. And yeah. Honestly, so, you know, I've used Mark III, Linux CNC, and Acorn. I haven't used Acorn on a real machine, but I've kind of tested it out. And, you know, even coming from that background of you know, expecting visual feedback, I honestly haven't missed it.
So you'd run simulations, I assume, in your case, Fusion 360.
That's correct.
So yeah. You'd run toolpath simulations and see how things would go. But once it's running, that's it. You're running blind.
Yeah. Yeah, and, wow. You know, it'll tell you... so it shows you like a distance to go when you hit feed hold. It'll say, oh, I'm going to move, you know, 1 inch in the X negative direction as my mm-hmm. next thing. But yeah, you know, the first time you run it slow. And I mean, you're going to do that anyway, mm-hmm. I assume.
Yeah.
Full speed. yeah. And honestly, it really hasn't been an issue. So yeah, I think it's a nice to have. But not strictly necessary.
Yeah. 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 I can't see why I'd need anything other than Gerbil for you know, for the basic stuff that
right.
I'm doing at the moment. But who knows? Who knows?
Yeah.
So what's next? So this week you've got your two CNCs up and running.
Yep.
What's the next sort of task?
Just getting blades ready for DLC coding. So yeah, lots of hand finishing, lots of sandblasting, lots of holding my aching elbows. yeah, just the grind this week. That's fine. You just gotta get shit done.
Yeah. Have you seen, so for those who aren't knife makers, the reason why knife makers always complain about hand sanding is the machine finish. You're never gonna have, you know, a nice satin finish. Or I mean, for your case, where you're coating with, it's not Cerakote, what are you using again? DLC.
Yes.
What sort of finish do you need before that's applied?
Very, very tight. Because the DLC is like really, really thin. It's only like a micron thick. So
right.
It doesn't hide anything. And in fact, because you have a very even color, it can actually show up issues.
Right, okay.
So yeah, it has to be like looking perfect before it goes to DLC.
Yeah. Wow. So,
bit painful.
Sorry, I was just mentioning about those who aren't knife makers. So, yeah, we generally hand finish blades. And if it's not been coated in any way, it's a bit of a thing, I suppose. Aesthetically, mm-hmm. it makes a difference. But other than that, it really doesn't. But you'd like to have those sort of hand sand marks running down the blade as opposed to perpendicular with a cutting edge.
Yes.
That makes sense.
And they have to be perfectly parallel and dead straight. And yeah, it's quite demanding.
Exactly. And if there was a machine that could do that, I'm sure everybody would buy one. But it's, you know, but you have things like plunge lines and things like that on knives, obviously. So that just makes it really difficult to sort of machine those in, or have like a buffing wheel that could do that for you. But that would be the dream. No more hand sanding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this... so like one of the things I want to talk about in this show is like stupid shit that isn't automated but should be. and I think that there's kind of an opportunity there. Like I saw a while back, I think it was a Russian guy, had a hand sanding machine. And so basically like the knife is sitting on a little platform, and then the platform is sitting on a thing that moves back and forth. And it was quite violent because it's not balanced, and it's this unbalanced knife wielding robot that shakes back and forth, you know, 100 times a minute. And then you hold your sandpaper up against it as it moves underneath you.
Wow. So like a sawzall. You could make one from a sawzall. Just strap your knife blade to
that. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds safe. Yeah, but I mean, if you did a version of that where there was a counterbalance going in the opposite direction, so that it wasn't shaking around like crazy, then yeah, like something like that actually makes a lot of sense. And they do have the opposite as well. So So a lot of the stuff that I've kind of learned in the last couple of years has actually been from the guys that do injection molds.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, for an injection mold, you might have a piece of steel that's like, you know, 12 inches by 12 inches. That's 60 Rockwell and has to be hand finished to a mirror. Mm. You know, the stuff that they have to do is pretty crazy. And one of the tools that they use is actually these little handheld, like oscillating machines that you mount a mold finishing stone in. And then it has like an ultrasonic actuator that moves the stone, you know, half a millimeter, 10,000 times a second.
Wow.
And just, you can just kind of scrub it around and it's like a little tiny orbital sander or something. You know?
Yeah. Wow. Well, where I get my, my blades, I get the profiles cut out, like the shape.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be water jet or laser cut out. And again, we talked about the last week how, you know, outsourcing the sort of the donkey work, if you like.
Such a good term.
That's in a place called Thiers, which is here in France. It's almost like the capital of knife making in France. It's where the Laguiole knives are made, and this Thiers has this shape that's regarded as a sort of a classic French shape.
Right.
But it's a really strange little town. So it's a town where 80% of the people within the town work in the knife-making industry. They have huge factories there. And it's tiny. It's a tiny little place, but it's just built around knife-making.
Sounds like I need to go there on holiday.
Well, they have a big festival every year called Coutelier. And it's like Blade Show.
Right.
But it's a European version, I suppose. And the whole village opens up. All the factories open up and people go and visit and you can exhibit your knives there and all. It's a really nice weekend because it's always roasting hot. You know, it's the middle of the summer. So it is a lovely place.
And it's in France, so there's probably great food everywhere.
No? I'm a bit of a myth, I'll be honest with you.
Showing my bias.
I think that the French food, they're still living on the glory days of maybe the late 70s, early 80s, and not much has changed since, so... If you're not going for the classics, which you soon get bored of if you live here, yeah, it's not the greatest.
Oh, no. Oh, thanks, Craig.
But I was mentioning these factories simply because they produce knives for bigger manufacturers, like Verstoff knives, for example.
Right.
A lot of these are produced in Thiers, not in Germany, as you'd imagine, and they outsource a lot of the work.
Interesting.
And I was looking around these factories, wondering how they finish, because there's nobody there hand finishing these knives.
No.
Everything is done by machine. So that they're milling the bevels, just as you do, but on these huge, huge industrial machines. The way they're finishing then, so I've just talked about hand sanding along the length of the blade to get these lines. You know, if you're doing the other way, which is perpendicular to the cutting edge, if you take it down fine enough, those lines will disappear. So that you don't then have to go that length way. So the way they do this is they have these huge, huge buffing wheels. I'd say probably 3 foot in diameter, huge, huge things.
That sounds dangerous.
Very, because yeah, the most dangerous machine in my shop, the buffing wheel.
Yeah.
But they have two. And they'd place them towards each other so they're actually running almost like cogs.
Right.
So they're almost like driving each other. And then they'll have this fixture where the blade is on, and they'll then put the blade through the middle of these two cogs and move in and out.
Oh, wow.
Now, you could never do this by hand, obviously, because that would just rip the blade out of your hand.
Oh, it depends how brave you are.
Well, or stupid. Yeah. But so basically they had a line of these different buffing wheels with different compounds on.
Right.
So they'd start rough, as you would with sandpaper. You'd start rough and work your way to a finer grit. And this fixture would hold maybe 40, 50 knives. And that would be on a wheel in itself. So that would turn. That would lower one of the blades into the wheel, out. Then the next one would go in. Then once all 40 or 50 are done, that would then be moved to the next bunch of wheels with a different rouge on them.
I just have an image of that wheel rolling down a hill chasing someone.
Yeah, with these 40,
with these knives,
blades.
Yeah.
But it's just really interesting to see how they do that, you know? And it's quite scary, some of the machines, because here in France, health and safety doesn't really exist.
Really?
Really doesn't. Well, we've been here, I think 4 years now. And when we first moved over, we were struck by just general day-to-day stuff. You could be walking down the street and see builders working on a roof of a house. You know, no safety equipment, not even a hard hat, nothing holding them onto the roof. And they're just walking around. And, you know, you go into a restaurant at lunchtime and... You know, it's quite a big thing in France, lunch. So people will stop for, you know, 2-3 hours. You know, wine will be consumed and you'll see them. All the workmen will be in the restaurant. They'd all be eating, drinking. And you walk past that same house a few hours later. And after they've had a big lunch and a few bottles of wine between the group of them,
right,
they're back up on the roof. And they're, again, not strapped on in any way.
Right.
So, yeah, that was our first realization that health and safety in France isn't the same as it is everywhere else.
Right.
But go into these factories and just seeing how no cages around any of these machines. And you can imagine, you know, a human being caught up in these big buffing wheels that I talked about. You can imagine a human going,
yeah.
If you'd imagine a like a car wash, you know how these big wheels spinning around.
Oh, God.
But imagine those wheels with a super grippy buffing wheel that's going, you know, 40,000 RPM or whatever it may be. It's just scary, scary. So you can see why they've got all these fixtures and mm-hmm. there's no real sort of human input with them just because it's just so damn dangerous.
Yeah, and it is amazing how far we've come with that stuff. Mm. I think, you know, something we should talk about in future episodes is like how machinery and automation has changed, you know, the life experience of the regular person.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I there'll be so many examples of that as well, you know, from the mundane to... You know, the crazy stuff that we talked about with rockets going up and coming back down because machines are built into these amazing tolerances. Yeah.
Well, and it literally the approach used to be like, oh, you have a dangerous, boring job that no one else wants to do. Get a kid to do it.
Yeah.
You know, in the 20s and, you know, 1910, 1920 or earlier, that was the go-to, you know, like, like someone inside the hull of a ship to hold the inside of the rivet while someone else wails on it, send a kid in there.
Oh, Jesus. You know? I've got daughters who just turned 2 this weekend.
Oh, they're old enough.
Them doing anything dangerous just it makes me sweat.
Right. Yeah, well, imagine sending your 8-year-old, you know, off to the shipyard. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, so it's amazing, you know, that we've come so far and still so many amazing things to go. Yeah, we're going to fucking space now, Craig.
Yeah, I know.
And
my kids will probably go into space. That's quite crazy to think. You know, they'll probably have the opportunity to, whereas I probably never will have. The rate things are going with maybe commercial space travel, it could be quite normal for them, you know?
I'm going to space, Craig.
You are going, 100%. Right, okay.
Yeah, I've told my girlfriend that if I die, I'm supposed to be shot into the sun. So even if I have to go there as a head in a jar or something, I'm going to space.
You're going.
Yeah.
Fair enough. 100%. Fair enough. But talking about the sort of dangers in the past of, you know, when they were, you know, using machinery to do things, that does remind me about back in Thiers. So as in this knife making village, they've got a big museum of, you know, knife making through the ages. And they've got these, you know, exhibitions, I suppose, so you can see how they did things. And there's a picture there, and there's a line that probably about 50 meters, and there's all these men just lying on the floor. And you're like, well, why are all these men lying? Are they dead? What's going on? And when you get close to the picture, you can see that each one of them is working next to a revolving stone wheel. And each of these are probably about 4 foot in diameter, you know, just over a meter in diameter.
And they're like coming up through the floor.
They're coming up through the floor,
right?
And these men are literally just lying down then, and they're doing bevels of blades, next to these massive rolling stones. And there's pictures then of, you know, some of these stones cracking and then just rolling onto the men, and it's just horrific, you know. Again, there's just no health and safety.
Yeah, and probably no safety glasses, no respirator.
You can imagine all that dust and crap everywhere.
Yeah.
But each of these men had a dog lying on them, which is why at first I thought, are they dead? What's going on? And they were issued with a dog when they started work for the day. simply because it was so cold in the warehouses where they'd be doing these, they'd have a dog lying on them to try and keep them warm.
What's wrong with a blanket? Why does it have to be a dog?
A dog. Yeah, this is amazing. I'll see if I can find that. There's bound to be
You're
a version of this
up,
online.
Craig.
I'm telling you.
I've zero faith in you now. You're just lying.
I shall try and find a picture online and post it up in the show notes. But
that sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, imagine being so cold, an issue with a dog to lay on top of you to try and keep you warm. And you're trying to do bevels on a knife with this revolving stone that could flatten you at any point.
Does the dog have a smaller dog lying on top of it?
Yeah, like Russian dolls.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's this little teacup terrier right on the very top.
It's crazy. Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen like... I forget which factory tour it was. I love watching factory tour videos. Mm. And it was like a Wusthof or something like that. And they had a six-axis robot arm inside a big steel cage. And in there, there was a couple of really big belt grinders and like a buffing wheel. And, the arm would pick up a blade out of a rack that had no bevels or anything and chuck it on one grinding wheel to do one side and then the other grinding wheel to do the other side. And then... onto the buffer, and then it would put a finished knife on the side. And it's just amazing.
It is, yeah. But when you think some people still do, I just mentioned the big stone wheel. Mm-hmm. There's still plenty of people making knives that way still. The whole thing of forging a knife, that's not required anymore. There's far better, I wouldn't say better, because they're angling a lot of people.
Yeah.
But I do mean better. Better ways of doing things.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there's definitely a lot of romanticism about the past. Things were better back then. But I think the people that are saying that didn't have to send their kids off to the cannery.
Exactly,
Go down to the shipyards, Timmy. Go make us some money. Like, I really do think that things have gotten better. For the most part, hopefully, and we'll continue to. I mean, we have rockets that land themselves now, Craig.
Exactly, exactly.
It can't be all bad. No.
Things are looking up for the future. I think that's a show. I think we've covered everything on our show notes for the week.
And we got into the weeds a bit, but that's all right.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. Yeah. That's what it's all about. So if anybody has any questions or maybe topic suggestions, things we should be talking about, let us know on our Instagram. So Aaron's is Aaron... Aaron Customs? Aaron Goff Customs?
No, not even close.
Just Aaron Goff?
It's just Aaron.Goff. So blow me up. If you think we're full of shit, let us know. If you think we're amazing,
let us know.
Tell
too.
Everyone.
Let us know. But yeah, reviews really help. We are now, as I say, streaming on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, all the platforms. We're everywhere. Give us some reviews, let us know how we're going, and if there's anything in particular you'd like us to talk about, or you'd like to mock my lack of knowledge in any sort of subject, please let us know.
Or you want to mock me because I'm talking about something like I know what I'm on about and I don't. That's good. I love learning new stuff, so if you hear me make a mistake, just tell me. That's fine.
Yeah, we appreciate that. Yeah. Definitely. So that's it. We shall speak to you again next Wednesday.
Have a great week, guys.
If you like this show, take a look at our other shows made for makers just like you at www.makery.network.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.